From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. Although Robert Redford is one of the greatest movie stars ever, these days much of his time is spent helping develop and showcase new talent. His Sundance Institute, which he created to support independent filmmaking, celebrates its 25th anniversary this year, and I'm very pleased that it brings Robert Redford to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
The Sundance Institute and Film Festival are based in Utah, but yesterday you announced a new collaboration between Sundance and the Brooklyn Academy of Music. So should we start thinking of Brooklyn as a sort of Park City East?
Well, the Dodgers were no longer available, so BAM seemed like a nice second choice.
Don't we get enough snow in Brooklyn as it is?
Well, what it amounts to is that for several years, it was important that we establish a home. A home away from home in New York in particular, because that's where my career began and much of my adult life has been spent, even though I was born in California. So the idea of it's kind of a home. I see it as a kind of home. And because I think Sundance has always sort of managed to operate by looking slightly off the grid or in the other corner, so to speak, as Freud might have said, that the mainstream part of New York exists around the Great White Way and is terrific, but it's loaded. The real estate is pretty well eaten up and pretty well established for what it is, which is more mainstream. It'd be like the equivalent of San Francisco and Oakland. So Brooklyn always kind of fascinated me when I was a young actor on the stage here in New York, watching what was going on over there and what Harvey Lichtenstein did in the early years to build it into a cultural institution. And as I saw it develop, it felt very right. It was exciting what they're doing, experimental stuff and so on. So then when Sundance started and got rolling, somewhere along the line, right around the time they did their first next New Wave festival, was about the time we started our festival. And Sundance was already 5 years in existence with its labs. And so about that time, I began to think about possibly someday hooking up. Would there be some synergy there? So finally that came to pass this last few years when it was clear that Sundance had developed enough stable elements in terms of development, and BAM was establishing its place as a place of showcasing and production. But both of us focused on the same mission, which was new artists and new voices and creating new audiences.
So what does this mean in Brooklyn? Are you going to have labs? Are you going to have a festival here?
No, the labs are out. No, what it will be taking our festival, which happens in about a week and a half out west, and scaling down some of the cream of the crop there to bring to BAM, not only in film but in theater, because we have a theater program that develops new works for theater, like last year was I Am My Own Wife and the Laramie Project and Light in the Piazza. Those were all developed at our lab project at Sundance. But since we only occupy ourselves with development, it's kind of like a baseball farm club. You know, you ship the talent to the majors. So the majors in this case would be BAM, because it's a place just slightly off-center, a little edgier, and it has a lot of space out there. So it feels like a good home away from home for us.
So you're going to pick 12 of the films that you feature in the bigger festival in Utah and send them to Brooklyn.
Yeah, and they'll be diverse in the sense that, you know, reflecting what Sundance is, which is, it's not just a film festival about just regular films. It's more diverse. It has international components that deal with cultural issues and political issues. It deals with documentaries very heavily and shorts. And so that diversity would be brought to BAM in a program.
Well, at a press conference yesterday at BAM, your director, Ken Brecher, joked that there wouldn't have been a festival last year without Brooklyn filmmakers. And The Squid and the Whale got its start at Sundance, didn't it?
That's correct. Yeah, there probably wouldn't be, we wouldn't have much of a foundation since our beginnings without Brooklyn, without New York.
But you went to school in Brooklyn, so you
I
have
did.
Other connections.
For a very short time, with not very illustrious career there, but I did at Pratt Institute. And
now, are you surprised by all the film people who live in Brooklyn these days or have moved there? We have Steve Buscemi, John Turturro, Jennifer Connelly, Michelle Williams, Heath Ledger, and I'm sure there are many others. And, of course, there's Noah Baumbach.
No, it doesn't surprise me, because when you really explore Brooklyn and you consider its history, its history would support why. You can go all the way back to literature coughing up stories from Irwin Shaw or Thomas Wolfe.
How about Walt Whitman?
Henry Miller, Walt Whitman, if you want to go back that far. I mean, Brooklyn has always been a place of new discovery, new talent. And I think because it's just slightly off the grid and there's more space there, and it's constantly rejuvenating itself in one way or another, it feels like the right place. And I think where artists choose to live, there's usually a very, very good, solid reason underneath it that's worth looking at.
And you've named the collaboration Creative Latitude, which is
no,
kind
I would,
of a pun.
I wouldn't name it that. I don't think that's a good name.
Oh.
It's kind of antiseptic and it's too academic.
Well, that's what I heard, because you're both at the same latitude,
Well, there's a better way to do it, I think. I think, for example, something like just latitude 40, Sundance at BAM. I mean, what is that? It's a little bit more intriguing and a little bit more aesthetic, so that'll probably be what it is.
Well, it can't be any more different than what you have out in Utah. You have 5,000 wilderness acres and a mountain with a river running through it?
Yeah, I don't own the mountain, but I certainly respect it.
We have Prospect Park.
Yeah, you do. Well, this is Promise Park, let's put it that way. The situation out west is that, you know, the reason I started it there was that I really had no other place I could afford to go, because I could contribute land, and I thought, well, L.A. or New York would be expected. I mean, that would be the normal place to go, because the film has a kind of an urban ring to it. And I thought, well, what if we... First of all, I couldn't afford to establish something in those cities. But how about going off the grid a bit and trying something different? See what happens when you put artists against nature. Now, that might be a disaster, or it could be productive. But mostly it's what I could afford to contribute, my own land, to the cause. So that's how it started. And then when it became clear that nature played a very positive role, then you could start moving it forward, like the showcasing of the festival and so forth.
Although writers have been going off to colonies for years, taking some time in isolated places where they could really concentrate on their work.
That's right.
I gather that you discovered Sundance by accident. You got lost on a trip when you were going home from college in Colorado.
Well, I don't know that I was ever lost, because I always enjoyed going off the beaten path and exploring. So sometimes exploration would get dodgy, but I always enjoyed it. And you know, maybe I had just basic faith that I'd find my way back somehow. But yeah, I just went off the main road and got on a tributary road, and I saw this incredible canyon that was sort of hidden. And I thought, this is amazing. And put my eye on it and kept my eye on that. And then later on went there and bought 2 acres of land in 1961 and started from there.
And now 5,000 acres, did I say?
It's about six.
Robert Redford is here. We're talking about, among other things, the new alliance, sort of, between Sundance and Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. You said that Sundance is more than just a film festival. There's the theater project. There are... how did all of this develop? You just thought that you'd have this lab and people would get together and start thinking about art?
Yeah, it was a series of... I'm sorry?
And they just start thinking about art?
Well, let's see if I can shortcut the process here. What started is to be just me putting something back in an industry that it had worked out very well. I thought, well, what can I do if I take a break? 1980, what can I do to maybe put something back? Came up with the idea for Sundance, which took about a year to gestate. That's why we started in 1981. And it was the idea of because I started in the theater, could you create an experience like theater has for film, which didn't have it, which is a rehearsal place, a place where you could stumble and explore and fail without being the end of the world. And so that's how it started. And it was just a lab. It was nonprofit. It started very simply and very humbly in 1980, 1981. And the idea was to create a space for new artists with new points of view, to have a place to come and really work without the hindrance of money or competition. That's how it started. Then one thing led to another. Once that survived, after about 3 or 4 years, then it was clear to me that there was a category there that might be tapped in terms of independent film. And because independent film at that time was pretty well relegated to arts panels and things of that sort with NEA and NEH, but wasn't kind of going beyond the classroom, so to speak, that maybe that was an area that we could enhance by feeding it with the new talent. So two things started to come together around our festival. So the festival is still nonprofit, creating a showcasing for these films that might never have a chance to be seen. Mm-hmm. So it was simply a question of development, step one, step two, showcasing so people could see it. And then one thing led to another after that. Once the festival looked like it would survive after about 5 or 6 years, then other opportunities developed. We just sort of seized them as they came so that there began to be a through line for Sundance and independent film.
And as you became more famous, I assume you started to be bombarded with requests for people to participate.
Yeah, I would have to say that there was some cost in this effort in terms of my own personal work, which left me with some mixed emotions. But on the other hand, a commitment is a commitment. And when I saw the opportunities increasing, it seemed to me I had to follow it through to where it is now. So,
mm-hmm. Well, one thing led to another. The people aren't expected to complete their films or their plays, are they? This is just a place where they can work out some of the problems?
Yeah, exactly. They come out there in our labs and they're encouraged to really, really go for it and take the big swing. And in order to take the big swing, you got to keep your focus. And the idea of focusing on script, showing that the role of the actor is important, can't be relegated to background in place of explosions and things like that. And I think independent film has probably been helped by the choice of the mainstream to go more following the youth market, to do more blockbuster-type films that are more expensive and more dependent on special effects and digitization and so forth. Whereas the more humanistic side of it, where Sundance fits, is more about storytelling and character-driven stuff. I think that's why you see more actors going into independent film.
When you directed your first film, it was at a time when we started seeing a lot of special effects. Was that also an attempt to show that just telling a story about a family would still work quite well, was still one of the ways that were options for filmmakers?
I don't know that I thought as broad as that when I did it. It was my first directing job, and I knew that it was time for me to direct. I produced and acted, and I thought, well, if I'm going to direct something, what would be the criteria? And for me, it was very simple. It had to be about feelings and behavior. So I found that project. So that was the main focus, was to satisfy myself about making an artistic effort around that you know, element. And so when it was done, I guess you could broaden it to say, well, was this the kind of film that was now going to be threatened to extinction? Was it going to be surpassed or overwhelmed by the mainstream moving in a different direction? I don't think I thought about that at the time I made the film. It had more to do with Sundance. That situation caused me to put more emphasis into Sundance because I did fear that as the industry got more centralized and focused on youth and more money, that you would end up with blockbusters and big action films. And what would happen to the more humanistic films?
Well, even if you hadn't intended it, Ordinary People did very well and won 4 Academy Awards, Best Director, Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor for Timothy Hutton, whose career really took off after that. And you had a terrific cast as well, Mary Tyler Moore and Donald Sutherland as well. So you were proving a point even if you weren't trying to make the point.
Yeah, exactly. And what intrigued me about that was, I think the most intriguing part of it for me was Mary Tyler's role. I'd never seen that character on film, but I had seen that character in life. And I thought, how interesting and exciting to try to bring a character who could create such mixed feelings. And could you possibly bring a character like that to the screen that would seem to be so brutally insensitive? And somehow, by getting deep into her dynamic, that you would find some sympathy or something to feel sorry for. That was very intriguing to me. And I thought she did really an amazing. She's so committed to that role. That was pretty courageous.
Have you, looking over this past year and the films that have gotten the most acclaim, they're pretty much all human stories. Brokeback Mountain, Capote, the Squid and the Whale. And it's interesting that this is in a time when the conventional wisdom is the only way you can really do well is if you have a lot of special effects. Some people have even complained that there were too many special effects in King Kong.
Well, I haven't seen King Kong, but I would certainly challenge the whole concept of conventional wisdom. I mean, conventional wisdom, if I had lived by it, I wouldn't be here. And so I'm not big on conventional wisdom. When I hear that, it's like telling you you can't do something, you automatically figure out a way you're going to do it. Conventional wisdom is just a signal to me to start moving in another direction. So the conventional wisdom, if it says blockbusters, it's pretty clear now that that's maybe run its course and the audiences are maybe getting tired of being overwhelmed by just special effects alone. They want more story. They want more characters. So these films and the films that Sundance sponsor or maybe finding a new place for themselves. I always felt that would happen because one thing's for sure, everything's cyclical. What comes up goes down and pendulum swings. And the whole emphasis towards blockbuster, you notice that, for example, most of the blockbusters out there are period pieces. So they're either going back to Days of Troy or the Crusades or what have you. Well, that works for a while, but then, what about today? And when it's that expensive and the amount of money that has to be brought in, the business equation gets pretty tricky. And to me, that's just sort of a dangerous game that's also not that much fun. You know, if you can just make a simple story simply told about something that really reaches human emotions, to me, that's always the kind of films that were appealing to me and the ones I would like to make. And I was just assuming that there were enough other people that wanted the same kinds of films and audiences that wanted them as well. That was why Sundance was a gamble that was worth taking.
Robert Redford is my guest. We'll be back with more. We're back with Robert Redford. Did you always want to be an actor? Because we talked about you going to Pratt, and you said that you studied painting. Was that your first love?
Yes. Well, first love, I guess, was sports, because that's what got me out of a kind of an unpleasant situation in Los Angeles. It was not a great neighborhood. It was kind of rough and working class. It went kind of sour after the war, and it wasn't a place that I really wanted to be anymore. I love the idea of New York, so. But art was my, outside of sports, it was art, and that's what took me to Europe to study and kind of go on the bum for a year and a half to have a life experience connected to that, which I did. And then I landed in New York, which was where I would much rather be, and that's how my life, my career life and adult life really began. But then a series of serendipitous turns took me into acting, which I hadn't expected beforehand, but once it hit, it was clear to me that that felt more right than anything.
But the acting in those days was on television and in the theater, which were pretty much the same thing in the 50s, weren't
they? Very exciting time. I came in, perhaps somebody always in search of a community and never quite found one, or came in as one was dying out, which maybe had something to do with starting Sundance to create a sense of community for the future. But when I came into television, it was the end of Live. And so I did one of the few last live shows, The Iceman Cometh, and Sidney Lumet, Jason Robards. That was exciting. And then there were some shows like Hallmark Hall of Fame. They were still Playhouse 90. I did the last one of those. But then it went out. And Broadway was still alive with Williams and Inge and Miller. But they went out shortly after I got there. So it was coming in at the end of an era rather than the beginning.
But many actors are coming back to the theater now.
Have
you been tempted?
There's a reason, I think. And theater, by the way, I think is is going back. It's re-improving itself. It's going back to what I remember was an exciting time when I was in the theater, which gave itself away to special effects. You know, when the 60s revolution occurred, suddenly everything was about taking your clothes off and screaming, kind of a primal scream, which was good. I mean, I think that was absolutely great. Hair was great. But, okay, it didn't have a lot of lasting power. It was just a moment of its time. And it never got replaced by the quality writing that was there before until now. I think now you're seeing some pretty exciting stuff. So sure, actors want to go where the work is good.
Drama is back on Broadway, and yeah. Broadway had its best season last year.
And deservedly with plays
like Doubt.
Pillow Man, I mean, it was some wonderful stuff.
So are you tempted at all, or is that too far in your past? Among your best-loved movies are the two blockbusters you made with Paul Newman. Wasn't George Roy Hill, the director of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, kind of reluctant to cast you in that film?
No, it was the studio that was reluctant. George wanted me, and he fought for me, and that's why I think I ended up in the film. And Paul stepping in, who had the final say because he was well-known and I wasn't. I think I probably owe getting that role to Paul and George in terms of where the power really lay, because it could have gone the other way. But he had to fight the studio, who didn't want me in there because I wasn't known. And I understand that. I mean, Paul was known, I wasn't. They wanted a parallel star. But it worked out the way it did. I think that George, by the way, I don't know that George has ever received as an artist, as a director, the full credit he deserves as a real craftsman. He did Butch Cassidy. I mean, the fact is that was a William Goldman script that was very catchy and attractive and very entertaining. But George is the one that gave it a kind of gravitas to mix with the humor that created that kind of interesting chemical makeup. And George was the one that stripped a lot of the jokes out and kept the really solid good points there. And he, in shaping it, he got the best out of it. And in The Sting, that's entirely George. I mean, George crafted that whole thing. It sits entirely on his back, including getting Scott Joplin for the music. And I don't know that he's ever received the credit he deserves, because he's, to me, the fundamental talent behind those two films. You know, whatever you want to say about Paul and I is one thing, but the real talent that put that thing in place for us to walk into was George.
You seem to have so much fun together. Is that just something that happened on the screen, that famous acting chemistry, or is that something that was also occurring off the screen?
You mean Paul and I?
Yeah.
It just happened. I mean, nobody gave any thought about it. No, and we certainly didn't walk into something saying, gee, let's talk about chemistry. I mean, that's just, that kind of stuff didn't happen. I think that's come in later years where people think about things like that because of marketing and the power of marketing. But
you also see it sometimes. You wonder, what are these two people doing together? They just don't seem to connect because there isn't that chemistry between them.
It just happens. And so therefore, because it happens, you don't question it or plan it. It just does. And that's the way it was with Paul and I. I think that because we were still at a time where craft played an important role in getting into the business. We came out of theater. We both had similar backgrounds and dedication to craft, so we approached the film roles with that same thing in mind, rather than, gee, let's be cute, or let's be clever, or let's give people a certain kind of personality. We didn't think that. We just thought about playing the characters and enjoying the camaraderie, which was that was part of the deal. You know, these guys were almost like enemy friends. They were such opposites, but they were bonded together by their opposite needs. And that's what was played, which meant you had to have some bickering, but underneath it, you knew there was a bond there that couldn't be broken. That's all. There was no thought that came into it. Nobody knew what kind of a film it was going to end up being. Nobody knew what kind of a chord was going to be touched. You just did it.
My guest is Robert Redford. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I read a newspaper story last summer that said that you and Paul Newman might star together in a new movie. I was thinking of a perfect title. How about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Festival Kid?
Well, we'll ignore that for your benefit, okay? I'm not going to talk about... Paul and I are talking about something, but I think it's best left alone until we do it.
There was also great chemistry with you and Dustin Hoffman in... all the President's Men. And that film is taking on a new resonance today for all sorts of reasons, partly because of what's going on in Washington, also because of what happened with Bob Woodward and the Plame story. Has that something you've been following a lot? Is it something that makes you think about your own part in the way people remember that story?
Well, sure. I mean, I started thinking about that long ago, not just recently. I thought about it when it wasn't an issue. I wondered why it wasn't an issue. And when the anniversary for Deep Throat came around, I was curious why, when there was a television station that came to interview me, and I actually refused to do the interview, and I realized all they were interested in was who Deep Throat was. I said, if that's why I've come here, it's a wasted trip. Why aren't you asking a more important question about, let's look at where things are now versus the way they were then? So that never really got fleshed out as much as a more shallow issue about who Deep Throat was. Of course, that's fun and games, but so? And so you get that. Now what? And so when the reveal came out, sure, I was fascinated and interested. But again, I didn't see enough connecting the dots about. And so then I thought, I'll tell you what it has done, is it's made me think a lot about why it is that we're in a situation now where the scandals that are occurring on a kind of a minute-by-minute basis are so much worse than what one scandal produced. And yet that one scandal in 1970, in the early 70s, produced such a tidal wave of domino falling that it changed everything. And now one issue doesn't seem to be enough to get the attention. So I was wondering, why is it that the American people would allow something so egregious where there are lives being lost and money's being lost and jobs being lost? Why would people either ignore it or not wake up to the effect of that? And I think what I came away with was, this might be one of the negative effects of new technology, that there's so much information. When you stop and think, when Watergate occurred, there were telephones, dial phones. There was no internet. There was no cable. Computers had not hit the scene yet. And there were like three major television stations except for CNN. And you think, well, that the focus, there was more time to focus on one issue and stay with it a little bit longer where you can get analysis along with it. So the public could say, whoa, wait a second. Now there's so much information going, it's such a barrage of images and hyperventilated news reports with tapes going underneath that counter what the face is doing. How can anybody stay collected long enough to digest anything?
There's also an argument that there was Watergate fatigue. The country didn't want to go through another Watergate. And then more recently, Monica Lewinsky fatigue. And so people are reluctant to go through another one of those traumas.
I think that the people are. I don't think the media is serving the public as well as it could, except for a few exceptions, that the media should keep to position a story not just for the trivial, shallow part and then jump off the ship real quick to go to the next one, but stay with it long enough to say, keep tuned into this. This is going to affect you somehow, some way. This issue is going to affect you, whether it's wiretapping or war in Iraq and deaths that occur, whatever it is, it's going to affect you, but you won't know about it if you skip off to the next thing.
One of the things that came out of all that obsession with Deep Throat was the point being made that Follow the Money, what everybody remembers in connection with Deep Throat, actually didn't occur in the book. It was in the movie only, which gives a sense of just how powerful films are in our culture.
Well, that's right. The film was quite an effort to take that book, which was so filled with names and dates and things that you had to strip it without losing the power of its essence, which is what these two guys did that very few people or nobody else did to get to the truth. Now, in order to do that, you had to strip a lot away. And I think that's one of the inventions of screenwriting, where screenwriting, when it's good, can hit something and give it emphasis, even though it may not have been in the book. But it's not violating anything. It's not violating the essence, because that's exactly what they did. They followed the money. So to have that said as a dramatic point, I think, was really great.
How much involvement do you have with the Sundance cable channel?
Well, as much as I can effectively execute, considering it's controlled by two giant corporations.
Mm-hmm. But did you just lend the name, or do you have real...
No. I have a creative... It's under my creative direction, but that's only as good as you're allowed, as the money people will allow. If you don't get the support financially, then there's not a lot you can do creatively. Now, that's one of the side effects and sometimes negative effects of stepping out of the nonprofit into the profit world, but you have to live with that. That's the rule of the game. But then that comes up, that whole thing about conventional wisdom. There's a lot of conventional formula thinking about money and profit. You can either create some sort of profit by cutting costs or by investing. And cutting costs, of course, that's all risk averse. And Sundance is very much about risk. So you can see right now that there's going to be some tension there with Sundance being in the corporate world, trying to engineer its independent path through it.
IFC, which also has a wonderful independent film cable channel, has just gotten into the movie business, the theater business, and I gather that there was talk of Sundance doing that, but that fell through?
No, as a matter of fact, that's back on again. What happened with that, you mean Sundance Cinemas?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all that was putting, since the festival created a whole new territory that was pretty exciting, which was international and documentaries, and I always believed in documentaries. I always thought they had immense power, and that someday they would either arrive at or deserve to be on an equal footing with major films.
And last year we saw Any Number do extremely well at the box
exactly.
office.
Exactly. So I started committing our energies to documentaries back in the late 80s, using the festival as a platform. So we created something called the House of Docs, and then eventually the hope was that there could be, we could do more. So when I started the channel, or tried to start the channel, one of the ideas was that we could use the channel to promote documentaries and their importance. So while all that was going on, we were also getting George Soros Fund for international documentaries that focused on human rights. So as this thing began to expand, suddenly we could play a role, or try to play a role, in using film more as a cultural experience rather than just straight entertainment. As a result, this new festival that's coming up, which celebrates our 25th anniversary, is going to be probably more about going back to our roots when we first started, edgier. You know, what's happened in the meantime, Leonard, is that once independent film was no longer dislodged from the mainstream, once mainstream saw films like Brothers McMullen knocking out big blockbuster films like the water thing, you know, big, huge. They were pushing that film out of the
theater. World or what?
Waterworld, yeah. They was pushing that film out of the theater. Then something happened, and Hollywood began to pay attention and say, "Wait a minute, there's gold here."
And then people got worried that Sundance was becoming another.
Yeah, once film Hollywood started to put its mind on it and try to pull it towards them, then people thought we were going that direction. No, it was just that Hollywood was coming in. So, which is okay, because the filmmakers always have a choice, as long as they have a choice. And so what happened was that because a lot of the films in the festival were sort of being front-loaded and attracting a lot of celebrities, the impression was that we had sort of moved in that direction. So this year is about, which is not true. What happens is the perception of the festival, if it's drawn too much from the outside, is going to create a distorted view. We've programmed it the same way every year. Because we're a nonprofit, we don't have to program for commerciality. We can do it for diversity. And to me, that's the commercial part of Sundance, is its diversity. So right now, we're trying to draw attention to the fact that this is the way we've always done it. So let's look at the films that are coming out, more focus on this year on small films that have big ideas. There are, for example, 34 women being represented this year, and 32 films about women. There is much more focus on the consequences of globalization and commerce on society, about relocation, dislocation because of war or catastrophe, coming from other countries, stories about issues that we don't get wind of because nobody has the courage to tell them. Those are going to be flooding the marketplace in the festival this year, and it's going to be quite exciting. There'll be a lot of junk. That's part of the deal. You know, that's up to somebody else to decide what's junk and what isn't.
But do you see every one of the films before it's screened?
Not every one. It would be impossible, but I see a lot of.
And that is coming up in a couple of weeks. And then when will the festival at BAM be taking place?
May. And that will just be bringing two. What a lot of people don't know about Sundance is that it's not just a series, it's not a festival alone, and not just a lab. It's a year-round workshop that focuses on writing, directing, and playwriting, and film, and music. So that has us operating in a kind of action mode throughout the year, so that these are just showcasing what we do all year round there.
If you'd like to get some more of Robert Redford, he'll be speaking tonight at 8 at the CUNY Graduate Center at 5th Avenue and 34th Street as one of the New York Times Arts and Leisure Weekend events. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great pleasure.
It has been mine as well.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.